All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood, and this is the Actual Anarchy Podcast, a podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight, we're going to be talking about a very classic film, Casablanca, with a very special guest. This is going to be episode 189 of the show. You can find the show notes and more at actualanarchy.com/189. But before we get to the last narrative portion of the show and introduce our guest, I'm going to check in with Robert and see how things are going on your side of the mountains where you have been mandated to enforce masks on your customers these days, Robert.
Yeah, we're supposed to kick out anybody that won't wear one. Now, I'm going to leave it to you to guess just how much enforcing we've been doing of this. Actually, we did have, it's always a little bit unsettling when there are like cops around. I don't know about you, but I get a little bit nervous just because of what I know about cops. But we had one in the parking lot. And he's just sitting there in the parking lot, and we're like, all right, what's going on? I mean, he's probably just here to get food, but who knows? He's just waiting and waiting and waiting. Then another one shows up, and then another one shows up. And then they're just having a chat out in the parking lot. And then they came in, and then the customer right before them gave us like extra money. And it was like, put this towards their tab. And I was like, I don't know how I feel about that. And then my business partner was like, yeah, and we're going to cover the rest if this doesn't cover it. So I get the idea that you want to like bribe the local thugs and whatever. Maybe they'll treat you better, that kind of thing. But it still just felt like this state worship that it was just too hard for me to swallow. So, I mean, I didn't spit in their food or anything. I served them perfectly good meals, but I wasn't, I just felt like a little bit off. I don't know. I mean, they're sheriffs. So that makes me feel slightly better about it. I mean, you don't hear a whole lot of like sheriff brutality stories, but it's still not great.
Yeah. The sheriffs do tend to be at least more rhetoric wise pro freedom and adhering to the Constitution. Now, I'm no fan of the Constitution. But as Dave Smith and Michael Malice was saying recently on their episode, Analyzing Anatomy of the State, that one of the Lysander Spooner arguments was, well, I'm not bound by the Constitution, but if you swore an oath to it in public office, then you are bound by it. And so I'm going to call you out if you're not going to adhere to what you have bound yourself to. And I think that's actually a good argument that I had not considered before. But anyway, I'm glad that you are not in a cell or 90 days in jail or a $5,000 fine for not enforcing this mandate.
Oh, and I didn't finish the entire story. So one of the sheriffs was wearing a mask. He put a mask on when he came in the building, but then when he saw everybody else wasn't wearing a mask, he took it off. And then the other two also just had never did just didn't wear a mask at all. So I don't know if this is a case of rules for thee and not for me, or it was just like, yeah, this is all bullshit. We're not going to do this. I don't know, but I thought it was, I guess I came off feeling okay about that part. And well, they didn't mention to me, like, you know, you need to enforce this or anything like that.
Well, in either case, that's actually, still worked out for you in the end. So that's good. And I actually have a point to make during the episode with our guest and the last nearest person show that will be related to this. So I'll save that nugget for the main portion of the show where we are going to introduce.
Sizzle.
Oh, yeah. Right. We got to leave the cliffhangers. All right. Mm-hmm. So, we'll be hitting up the Last Night Sports Show, introduce our guests right after this. Hey, everybody, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are The Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction. Check it out at thelaunchpadmedia.com. You can also find this episode of The Last Nighters at lastnighters.com/132, as this is the 132nd episode of the show. And tonight, we're going to be reviewing the Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman classic, Casablanca, before it gets deplatformed, because if that happens before doing this one, we'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon. And for the rest of our lives. So of all the podcasts in all the libertarian sphere in all the world, our guest walks into ours. Our guest is Peter Quiñones, also formerly known as Mance Rayder. And this is a continuation of a beautiful friendship. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Quiñones. Just a little bit about you. You have done over 440 episodes of your show called The Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, and you were also very instrumental in bringing about the new and very timely documentary, The Monopoly on Violence, which introduces the state to people in a new way that is similar to our mission on this show, where we introduce concepts, libertarian ideas in film that people may already be familiar with. So welcome back to the show. Here's looking at you, kid.
Awesome, man. Really shocked this isn't a Kevin Costner movie, but you know, hey.
Yeah, I don't know what you're doing here.
Yeah, what am I doing here?
Yeah, well,
what's the next one we're gonna do?
What's gonna be The Postman, but yeah, then because it's gonna be, I think, in the fall and it's JFK time, and that's also a Costner flick. We were thinking good about movie. Maybe that one.
That's a good movie too. That's another movie I've seen many times. So yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah, so, you know, we can just go through the Costner flick stuff and in the pre-show bonus content available for our Patreon supporters. We were talking about some other great movies that you're interested in. I don't know how much we can fit into this casing of sausage that is our show, our Sausage Fest show here. But this is a movie that I was reaching out to you in the spring and I was like, hey, you know, let's do Postman. And then I think you said, hey, I want to do something before that, you know, like sometime in July. And you said Casablanca. So what was the thing that drove you to want to do this? And this is, of course, before the COVID panic and the BLM stuff that, like, everything's kind of being canceled now. And I think that this one is, quote unquote, problematic for a few reasons. And so it might get altered or in some way, like, changed. So I'm glad that we're doing this. But what was, if you can think back the few months back, what was the driving force between you wanting to do this one for this appearance?
I had just watched it. Oh. So it was like just one of those things. It's a movie I've probably saw this movie for the first time when I was like 8. My mom was really into Humphrey Bogart movies. My mom was, you know, she liked real men in movies, you know. She thought Tom Selleck was like the most awesome thing, and for the more modern day at the time, but she really thought Humphrey Bogart was like a real man. And she just loved this movie. So it's a movie I watch every once in a while. So I had just happened to watch it when you reached out, and it being a war movie, I think it's kind of hard to find libertarian themes when a war is going on, especially World War II raging. And, you know, I mean, this movie has everything. It has Nazis and, the worst of the worst. And yeah, I just thought this would be an interesting one to go through. And then, of course, I told you in the pre-show that when I went through it, it's like, it's really hard to find libertarian themes, but I think I found some. And I think that the more we talk about it, I'll be able to pull some more out.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. In watching this again, I'd seen it back in 2008 for the first time. And that was just based on, this is a movie that's a classic. And I kind of went out and, saw it on a buddy's shelf and asked if I could borrow it just so I could see it. And then I watched it again for preparation for this show. And I saw it in a whole new light, and there's a lot to this, and it's going to be a lot of fun, I think, having this conversation. But how we normally start off is with the Google description. So I will start with that, and we'll go to Robert for his opening information related to this. So Casablanca came out 1942. It's a romance / war film, 1 hour, 42 minutes, rated PG. Got 8.5 IMDb, 99% Rotten Tomatoes, 100% Metacritic, and 86% of Google users liked it. Won an Academy Award for Best Picture. And the description reads, Rick Blaine, played by Humphrey Bogart, owns a nightclub in Casablanca. He discovers his old flame, Ilsa, played by Ingrid Bergman, is in town with her husband, Victor Laszlo. Laszlo is a famed rebel, and with Germans on his tail, Ilsa knows Rick can help them get out of the country. The director was Michael Curtiz. It features the song As Time Goes By. As I said, it won Academy Award Best Picture. The Epstein brothers wrote the screenplay along with contributions by Howard Koch and Casey Robinson. It has Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, Paul Henreid, Claude Rains, Dooley Wilson, and Peter Lorre playing the guy who steals the papers. Yes. Robert, what is your take on the opening information, sir?
Well, this is from, I mean, obviously from a time when all you have is story and character. And so you better get that part right if you're going to make a good movie. And they did. This is a really snappy dialogue type written movie. It reminds me of your West
Aaron
Wing.
Sorkin.
Exactly. Yeah, Aaron Sorkin type stuff. It's very much like Humphrey is just this, what are you doing tonight? I never make plans that far ahead. I mean, you know, I mean, come on. What do you think of me? Do you think about a bad person? If I ever gave you any thought at all, I maybe never. Yeah, I probably would. I mean, just that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, it gets you a sense of who this character is, and it makes you laugh at the same time. The movie itself, though, it's got all kinds of action in it. It really gives me the sense, though, that it almost portrays the Nazis. I mean, this is the movie came out in what, 1940, 42.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, this is at the Nazis at the height of their power. And they haven't been fully, like, I don't know, full on demonized yet, I guess. So you get the sense that they're the height of their German like efficiency, and like they're still following like their rule of law. Like they've kind of set up these laws, and you got these like German commandants and whatever's down here in Casablanca, and they have a member of like the leaders of the resistance, and they're just like, well, we're just going to meet with you in this bar, and we'll arrest you on charges. And, you know, we're going to do all this official stuff according to the rules that we have laid out as these German people. We're not going to just, you know, grab you in the middle of the night and hit you over the head or whatever. So that was interesting to see that. It really kind of like, yeah, that makes more sense that the Germans would actually, I mean, at least in this setting, act in this way. But this is a really well done film. It's the source of all those famous lines that you've heard a million times, and they're just all in this movie.
And a lot of them are not right. The way they're portrayed now, like play it again, Sam, that's not actually ever said in the movie. So yeah, a couple of the lines that are supposed to be classics from this are actually misquoted. The play it again, Sam is most famous one. She says, I can't remember if I wrote it down or anything, but she says, play that one or something like that. Sam, play that one. Yeah, she never says, play it again, Sam.
Yeah, she says, play it, Sam, play as time goes by.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And then when Bogey says it, he's like, you can play it for her, you can play it for me. If she could stand it, I can stand it. Something like that.
What I thought, what Robert was talking about, the way I see it is, we've talked about how this was a written for a play, but the play was never produced and they just turned it into a movie. My idea is that during World War II, a lot of things were produced to be propaganda. And this is easily a propaganda piece against the Germans. I guess at some point we'll talk about the part where the Germans are singing and then the French start singing La Marseillaise. Yeah. Cause that's probably one of the most chilling, one of the most, you know, goosebump parts of it. And I have a couple things to say about Rick at that moment, but I think this movie was chosen to be made because it could be used as propaganda against the Germans.
Right. Yeah. And I think that the writers, those Epstein brothers, they wrote the first part of this and then got pulled off to another wartime documentary or propaganda film. I forget what it was called. Is it Why We're There or Why We Fight? Something like that.
Why We Fight. Yeah.
Yeah. Why We Fight.
Yeah. So then another writer came in and did part of the second half of the film and added a lot of the romantic stuff, I think. And then the Epstein brothers came back, and I watched some of the behind the scenes documentary last night after I finished the film. So I was up pretty late. And it was really interesting because they kept saying like they didn't know how this was going to end while they were making it. Like they kept doing rewrites and script edits, on set the whole time. And you can actually kind of, I think it actually helps the film because the actors don't know what the ultimate resolution is going to be. So they can't play as if they know, because they don't, because no, not even the writers knew at the time. And how it sort of developed, it's like they're under all this pressure and all this constraint to get something done and to get it done the right way. And they sort of have this idea and they're sort of feeling their way around. But then when you look back on it from this perspective and watching, you're like, well, that was great. I mean, that is, it ended how it began. You know, they bookended it with Round Up the Usual Suspects. That was totally like added in, you know, like before they were, you know, before they were even done shooting it. Or, you know, they were about done shooting it. And then they came up with that. And then they had Bogey come back in for that very last line where they're walking off together at the airport into the fog. He came in and voiced over that months later in time for the release. Cause they were like, we need something to just cap it. And it's one of the most memorable lines, you know, hey, Louis, this is going to be the start of a beautiful relation or a beautiful friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that means that they're going to go off and, he was one of those guys who's like a pragmatic
agorist.
Yeah. But he's also like willing to do what he needs to do to stay in the good graces of those wielding power over him. But as soon as he has the ability to break away, then he does. So he's going to go with Rick to wherever and actually join the active resistance against the Vichy and against the Nazis.
In the beginning of the movie, I would say the first half of the movie, he comes off as a Stirnerite, like an individualist anarchist, where he's just, I'm in it for me, I don't care about anything else. And then you see, especially after the big reveal of the relationship between who Laszlo is to her, actually who Laszlo has been the whole time, then you see he sort of changes and he... Okay, I need to do something here that's not so selfish.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Bogey was also similar, but he was like this. He didn't want to get entangled, and I thought that was a great. They talked about foreign policy and like his actions. Were talking about he didn't want to stick his nose in anyone else's business. He thought it'd be better to just leave everything alone, just remain neutral, look out for himself, and make sure that his sphere, his business and his employees are taken care of. He even talks about how, and I actually love this. This is part of the Sorkin-esque writing, but when he's talking with, who's the guy who's trying to buy the bar from him and he keeps trying to hire Sam away.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
Martini or Ferrari. Ferrari. And he's talking to Ferrari and he's like, when he's finally willing to sell, he's like, and Sam gets 25%. And the guy's like, no, I know he only gets 10, even though he is worth 25. But you know, he's like always using an angle to try to get an edge, to help out his buddy or, you know, whoever is important to him. And he does it again when, this is related to, Renault being kind of this sleazeball where he's offering diplomatic papers to that young Bulgarian couple. If the wife sleeps with him, and they had to be really careful to get that kind of nuanced message out there in such a nuanced way, to get past the censors. And there was another thing related to Ilsa and Rick alluding to having had relations or not. And they had to be really careful about that as well. But we could see Renault was definitely using his position to get personal favors or personal enjoyment out of it. And Rick stepped in and was like, put it on 22. Mm-hmm. All right, leave it there. Put it on 22 again. You know, leave it there. And he gets enough money to pay off Renault and gets that couple out of that kind of gross situation. It's almost a, what was that movie with Woody Harrelson and Demi Moore? The Indecent Proposal.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of like a precursor to that. But so Rick, like he has a good heart, but he wants to play it super neutral. Like he doesn't want to get in hot water. And Renault is similar. Like he's pragmatically trying to do what is being requested of him to not get in trouble. But he's also maybe more on the doing it on the more evil side of the coin, I want to say. Like Rick's more benevolent, even though he wants to play it off. His rhetoric is not benevolent. He's like, I'm looking out for me. I'm not worried about anyone else. But then he'll actually do things for other people. Whereas Renault is like trying to take advantage of people using that position of power. So I thought it was an interesting contrast, and they sort of worked together to both play off of each other to get what they wanted by the end. And there was a tension there. You know, you believe that Rick is willing to shoot Renault at the end. And I think Renault believes it well. And then they just get past that as soon as they kill Strasser. He's like, all right, well, you didn't kill me, so let's.
Well, they're black marketeers. They're they operate outside the system. They just know that some force may be needed to get the point across at a certain time. And I mean, I think Renault knew Rick enough, especially if you just take into consideration how Rick presents himself to Renault, what Renault witnesses Rick doing during the movie, you know, no previous history needed. I think Renault knows that Rick will do whatever needs to be done in order to achieve his ends at that point.
Yeah, I would agree. I'd agree with that. Robert, you want to take us in a direction here?
Well, I was struck by the similarity of the Rick character in this film with another one of my all-time great film characters. And he has the exact same arc as Han Solo. He's a funny guy. He doesn't want to get involved. He doesn't want to get caught up in this rebellion. He doesn't want to get caught by the Empire. He doesn't want to stick his neck out. But then at the very end, he takes a stand. He comes back in. He saves his friend. And he knocks Darth Vader out, and Luke Skywalker blows up the Death Star, or, you know, what's her name gets on the plane with what's him a dude. So you could tell which movie I'm more familiar with. But the characters were very similar. Characters very similar, and the arcs are very similar. So I don't know if George Lucas was just watching this movie and he's like, yeah, I'll just copy paste this character into this movie and it'll work.
Casablanca in space.
Yeah. But I mean, you meet him in a bar.
Well, it is an opera. I mean, Casablanca, it could very well, you could do that as an opera. And you know, Star Wars is referred to as a space opera. So, yeah, there are a lot of similarities there.
For sure. But that's, that's what I had for that.
I mean, there was a bunch of things in there that I thought were interesting. The way they would scan the room of Rick's, scan Rick's, where you would see different conversations going on. I thought one thing that was very interesting to a libertarian was apparently the diamond market was oversold. People are trying to sell diamonds and they're not, they're abundant. I guess everyone who was coming from escaping France or escaping Europe with their wealth, a lot of them were bringing diamonds with them, and it just had gotten to the point where it's like, well, I mean, I can't give you market value for these diamonds because I have too many. And so there was a supply and demand issue there that I thought was pretty libertarian.
Yeah. That's a good point. And good pickup on that. Cause you're right. There's so many people flooding out trying to take, you know, whatever condensed amount of value they can, that's portable with them. And so that would lead to being an overabundance of that being carried through and being used in exchange for these government documents that allow you to leave. And of course, the ultimate holy grail of these was the ones that Rick ended up having, because they were signed by General de Gaulle himself and could not be questioned by anybody. And this goes back to Robert, point.
I loved where he hit him. That's the best.
in the piano. And this is the other thing, you know, Robert, you may mention this in your open, where they're still following like this legalese where you'd think that today they just do a no-knock raid and grab the guy or just shoot him in a hallway or something, you know, something awful. But they know that he's the guy that they're looking for, even though they're evil, dastardly pieces of shit. But it's where they stick to this like code of, well, it's not legal to do it that way, so we're going to go through legal channels even though we're fucking evil.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny for a propaganda piece. It doesn't portray the Nazis as, you could see that it was early enough in the war that it's portraying the Nazis as the enemy, but it's not portraying the Nazis as like over the top evil sons of bitches.
Right. Yeah. And the propaganda part that really stood out to me was when they talk about, how do you think it'll look when you didn't like how we looked when we were in Paris. How about when we're in London? How about when we're in New York? And Bogey's like, well, there's a couple of neighborhoods I wouldn't suggest you try to go into.
I love that, man. That is such a great conversation right there. There's this, and mentioning Sorkin, I mean, Sorkin, his dialogue is just classic. I know the newsroom on HBO was a leftist, you know, thing, but I still loved it. I mean, the dialogue was great. A Few Good Men, the dialogue in A Few Good Men was great. I mean, that's all Sorkin and everything, but the dialogue in this is just, there's so much to pick up. One of my favorites is when he's talking to Peter Lorre, and Peter Lorre looks at him and goes, Rick, I can't remember what he says, but I think you think I'm a parasite. And he goes, something like, I don't mind parasites. I object to a cut rate parasite. And that really sets it up for the whole Rick character, you know, exactly who he is. I mean, he's a wheeler dealer. He's going to figure his way out of it. And he's going to figure how he is going to benefit from the whole thing. And I mean, it's just, that's one of my, I don't know. It's like Michael Corleone or Rick Blaine. I don't know who's like my favorite like character in like movie history.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I actually liked Ugarte's Peter Lorre. He played Ugarte. His position was, I'm providing a valuable service for people. Sure, I go through like slightly nefarious means, and I'm led to believe that he actually committed the murder on the train to get these documents. So I wouldn't like praise him for that, but for the other things that, you know, he is providing a service within constraints of, well, you need paperwork like this to be able to travel through here and get back to Portugal and then out to America if that's where you're wanting to go to get out of Europe. So it is a bit black market. I mean, there's so many black market actors in this, but they're working within this governmental like constraint that's trying to prevent people from doing things that they would otherwise freely choose to do. So he is actually helping. And that's the parasitic nature he's trying to describe to Rick. And I think that he's trying to say that he's doing something good, even though he's doing it sort of not in the best means or methods. And Rick's reply is, like you said, he doesn't like the cut rate one. So do you think that Rick is saying, well, I appreciate that you're doing what you're doing, but you should be better at it? Is that kind of what Rick's trying to say?
I think Rick is just saying, I don't like you. That's his way of saying, I don't like you.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And he even says, Rick, I know you don't like me, and that's why I trust you. That's why I trust you with the papers.
And you know what? That is a great line. That is a great line, because it makes so much sense when you think about it. It's not something that you would normally hear in a conversation every day, but the fact that Rick doesn't like this guy and would hide this for him is, it makes sense in some odd way. I mean, I think anyone who's familiar with black and gray markets would really get that, you know. And one of the things about, you talked about the black market is, there's a great quote that I can't remember who said it was. It said, the second a government is formed, the black market exists. And that is double for when a war breaks out. As soon as a war breaks out, or any kind of aggression, North Korea kind of thing, what's going on, the black market is going to be everything. And I mean, this whole movie is about really the black market. And I think that it's, I'm going to try and make it an Agorist classic. I'm gonna start passing it around in my Agorist circles.
No, I think you should, and it does fit that idea, because like all the major players are in the black market, and there's a respect for each other, even though they're competing, and there's even respect amongst Renault for them, because he sort of like turns a blind eye towards some of the things that he could otherwise shut them down for. And it's demonstrated very, very openly when Strasser says, you need to shut this establishment down. And Renault's like, this place is immediately shut down. Everyone needs to leave. There's gambling here. I'm surprised. Here's your winnings, sir.
I'm shocked that there's gambling going on here. Here's your winnings, sir. Oh, thank you. It's so classic. I mean, that's like that line itself is part of culture. I'm shocked. I'm shocked to find out that's going on here. People do that all the time.
Yeah. And it's an example of the government shutting down a bar for some made up reason. It's very familiar.
Yes. A little on the nose for these days. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it is amazing, like the amount of power that they wield, and they can use it towards personal gain, or just if they're in a bad mood, you know, then they're just going to shut you down. It's it's one of the reasons why I'm all for decentralizing as much as possible down to the individual unit if we can.
So here's a question that I had, and we already mentioned this, but in the ending, when Rick does pull the gun on Renault, is he violating the non-aggression principle when he does it?
Because Renault is calling Strasser. Is that his name, right?
Yeah, Strasser, yeah.
Strasser to come and violently
take
Laszlo. And, yeah. It seems to me like he's coming to the defense of another, but it's you know, a few steps removed, right? I mean, there's no guarantee that Strasser's going to make it there. So I don't know. That's a tough one. What do you think, Dan?
Well, I'm going to agree it is a defensive thing, but it's also one of those situations where because it's officials and you're totally outgunned, if you're caught, you need to be in a very advantageous position to be able to pull it off. Because otherwise, it's a fool's errand. You know, you're not going to survive that encounter. But I think that he knew that Laszlo would be put in a concentration camp and or killed, and that something would happen to Ilsa, and he still, of course, has feelings for her, doesn't want to see anything like that happen. So, but there's also sort of this, like, Renault called Strasser because pragmatically he had to, because if he didn't, then it would fall back on him if it was discovered later that he allowed this to happen and didn't tell Strasser. So he kind of had to do that based on his character and his personality. But I think he also knew Rick, like you were saying, Pete, that he knows Rick is willing to shoot him, but that he's not going to without good cause. Like, he's not just going to do it to do it. He's only going to do it if he doesn't do as Rick is saying. And they're friends, you know, they have a mutual respect for each other. So I don't think that he was really, it wasn't like a imminent threat of death kind of thing. It was more of like, I really need you to do what I need you to do. Otherwise, I'm going to be forced due to my code to do this. And it's sort of like what Ingrid Bergman did to Rick earlier in the movie, where she's like, I need those papers. Otherwise, we're going to die.
What about the first rule of handgun ownership or gun ownership? You don't point anything at anybody that cops violate all the time unless you intend to destroy that thing.
Are we critiquing the homeowners defending their house in St. Louis? Is that what that was?
I don't think that. Did he actually? I don't think he should have actually pointed the muzzle at the crowd. No, either one of them.
Stage, but whatever. I mean, there's a guy with a $5,000 microphone and shock mount pointing at the couple. And okay, whatever.
Yeah, it does seem a little convenient, but you're right, Robert. Yes, you're not going to point it at anything you're not willing to destroy. Also, you're not going to put your finger on the trigger until you have acquired the target and you're willing to destroy the target and whatever's beyond it. And I saw the movie poster for, I don't know if it was for this or for another Bogart film, but you know, his fingers, of course, like right on the trigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got it on it the whole time.
Yeah.
Maltese Falcon?
I think so, yeah. And that's very common. I mean, especially, like, they've gotten better about it in more recent times as far as...
Especially with the John Wick movies. The John Wick movies are the best for that. They're the most realistic gun movies I've ever seen, with magazine changes and everything, so...
Yeah, yeah, and like the cover art for films and movie posters used to always have fingers on the trigger, and now it seems like it's less so. So there's more awareness of that, which I think is actually an improvement.
Doesn't look as cool, Daniel.
Well, okay. I used to think that they would do that so that would be what people thought, and that guns would seem more dangerous, mm-hmm. and so it would lead towards more of a cultural shift towards wanting to regulate firearm ownership and all that. Just seemed to like play into the progressive narrative, like, oh, you can't have guns around because people are going to just go around shooting everyone, fingers on triggers and whatnot.
Right.
So I had a question about, okay. Now, what is your opinion? Why do you think Rick, at the time when the Nazis start singing their song and Victor Laszlo like loses his shit and runs over to the band and says, start playing La Marseillaise. And the band is like, what do we do here? And they look over at Rick and Rick goes, yeah, go ahead, play it. Why do you think Rick did that?
Yeah. He's kind of drawing a line in the sand there. I mean, he's taking a stand a bit in his own, you'd think he would want to be Mr. Neutrality and let it all play out however, but he makes the call.
It's his house, his rules, and it's still was it French occupied like lands?
Morocco,
it
wasn't, right.
Morocco, yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't Germany, and most of the people who were in the establishment were French, patriotic French. So I think he was playing the room a little.
Right. But the Nazis, they kind of just took it. I mean, when they lost, they were like, oh, I guess we got outsung.
Yeah. Well, there were like five of them and 50 other people.
They could have started some shit. They could have started shooting up the place. I mean, you don't know.
Well, they shut it down right after that, like in response to that. I mean, that was the thing that got Rick's place shut down.
That was a pretty, I mean, that was a emotionally charged scene. You know, when they scan to the one, I guess it was Rick's girlfriend who had been, the one that they reveal that Rick had been sleeping with at the beginning, but now he's not anymore and everything. And she's singing La Marseillaise and she's crying. And that's a pretty emotional scene for a movie, especially during wartime.
Yeah. And when the playwright was writing it, he said that when he wrote that scene, he was crying because of it. Like it made him weep because it was so emotional.
Well, especially with the Germans occupying France at the time and Morocco. Yeah.
Right. And that scene actually reminded me of recent events. 4th of July just happened. And I don't know if you guys experienced this as well, but I noticed there was a hell of a lot more firework activity than ever before in my neighborhood. And I saw on Twitter, there was a news helicopter in LA and it was like panning the city. And there's just fireworks everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And the voiceover is, even though fireworks are illegal in LA County, people seem to be disregarding this. And like it was thousands and thousands and thousands of fireworks just in this shot. And it reminded me of, or this scene reminded me of that, because it's like, I think people are fed up being locked down by the coastal elites who are like buying this pandemic hook, line, and sinker. And people are over it. And they wanted to show that in some way by disregarding some bullshit laws about fireworks. And it gave me a little bit of hope because like most of the time I think, and we talked about this on the Patriot episode, Robert, that most people I think just celebrate Independence Day just for the sake of blowing shit up. Like they've lost all connection with what the purpose behind it was and what we were actually celebrating. You're actually celebrating a secessionist movement. But it gave me a little bit of hope, like people are maybe giving a big F you to the GOV.
Yeah. But it's, it's either, you know, a lady who won't sit at the back of the bus, or it's a small act of defiance that doesn't lead to anything else. Like they're gonna do it because everybody else is doing it, and nobody's getting caught doing it. I don't know if this is indicative of a larger sense of courage among everybody.
Occam's razor. It could just be a bunch of bored people. Like, well, all right, we're going to just blow shit up.
And I'm glad that they defied Newsom's bullshit order, or who were the mayor of Los Angeles.
Garcetti or Garcetti.
I mean, I'm glad, but I wish they would take it the next step further. I mean, open up all your businesses and see who's going to get caught. You know, I mean, keep going. Keep going, you pussies. I mean, that's what I say.
It didn't happen here. I live in a really weird neighborhood. Where I live in it, I don't live in Atlanta proper, but it used to be Atlanta. And it's just really weird out within what should be a city limit. It's like a really hidden neighborhood where if you don't know where it is, you really are not going to, you're not going to find it. it might even be hard with GPS, but it was about the same fireworks as we normally get around here. So my cats were like, what the hell's going on around here? What the hell's, are we at war? But otherwise it wasn't different here, but I know in New York, from people I've talked to in New York, it was absolutely insane there. And it was like, and some people had private fireworks that were professional quality.
It does give me some hope that, I mean, the harder you squeeze, the more we slip through your fingers, that kind of style. Like the more we clamp down, the more natural the resistance will feel, I suppose. But I want people to not just leave it at fireworks. Keep it going, man. Hope that's infectious, right? Be as infectious as the stupidity you're sweeping the planet with the coronavirus. I mean, come on.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I had another question about the movie related to the movie. I mean, if you're in a war zone and obviously bombs aren't dropping in Casablanca, but there is a lot of politics going on there. I mean, do you abandon principles? Is it okay to abandon principles? Is it okay that somebody who isn't even aggressing against you, but might be coming to check up, you know, oh, I'm just walking up to your house to see who you are and everything, and it's somebody who has a swastika on their arm. I mean, is it okay to take them out without any aggression on their part? So one of my questions about the movie was just watching it and seeing all the black market activity that was going on is if you're in the middle of a war, are you sticking to your ideology?
Yeah. When is it okay to kill a tax collector? You are being aggressed against, not necessarily maybe by this person, but by other people that they might call. Kind of not the moral actor in the situation. I mean,
so what do you do?
I think it's, you got to be the pragmatist and be like, well, which is the least inconvenience, you know, which is the lowest risk that's going to allow me to pursue the remaining freedoms that I have available to me. And you got to like sort of compromise your principles a little bit and be a little bit like how Renault was, where he would do things that he probably wouldn't otherwise have done, because if he didn't, then he would not be able to maintain his position. He'd probably end up in a camp.
Another question another thing that I wanted to point out was Rick seems, his character, especially from the beginning, seems very harsh, very self-centered. He really does seem like he was, and this is something that would go to like bake the cake kind of libertarianism. He's very exclusive about the clientele that he allows into his casino. There are people who are stopped at the door and he says, no, you can't come in here.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good scene. Yeah. You know who I am? Yeah. The guy that's going outside.
Yeah. So, there was that. I caught that too. I was like, you know, as soon as I saw that, I'm like, oh, it's bake the cake. You know, it's like, you should be allowed to, it should be okay for you to allow anyone into your business that you want to, no matter what.
Yeah, or not, you know, refuse service. A lot of people used to have signs up that said no shirt, no shoes, no service. Now they say no mask, no service, whatever. And this is like a very touchy point, but the question of, you know, if it's your property, it's your business, you should be able to have anyone there, free association, who you want, for whatever reason. And it doesn't matter what that reason is, and other people should be aware of it, or so that they can make their decision on whether they want to patronize you or not.
You'll pay the market price. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Similarly, we talked about this, I think last week, regarding Costco, because I had a picture of myself in one of our groups where I was wearing a mask in Costco, and it was just to collect some money because they give you a rebate, and I was getting the cash. But when it was Costco's policy to require masks to go in there, that they had to pay the price of that. Like fewer people were going to Costco. Then they got up with the governor of our state and agreed with his mandating it for all businesses in the state. That's where it drew the line for me. And I was like, okay, you guys are offloading the cost of this upon others to do something that you're already doing. And it was a comparative advantage for them to not be doing this. So maybe people would have been more inclined to go to some other shop than Costco. But now you're going to force this on everybody in this protectionist kind of scheme to make everybody have to wear masks. And since you're already doing it, you're already bearing the cost of it. You're now leveling like the price that customers are going to pay and therefore the cost that you're going to pay as a store in your loss of foot traffic and revenue and whatnot. And so that was a big issue for me where, you know, I'm actually questioning whether I want to continue patronizing them or not. Because when it was just them, I'm like, okay, your house, your rules, fine. But when they start imposing it on others through the force of government, that's where I take issue with it.
Right. You take issue with it. And I understand and fully agree with you. But you also recognize that every corporation does this, right? Every Walmart argues for the minimum wage. You know, I mean, every corporation tries to lobby government for protectionist measures to level the playing field.
Every corporation acts like a state. Yeah. Every corporation, think about it. Corporations have, if you're an LLC, you have protections, state-like protections. The officers have certain immunities. You can sue the corporation, but you can't sue Sam Walton if you slip and fall. Corporations are just a mirror of the state.
Yeah, though I do think that there are certain, I think Kinsella talks about this, there are certain like structures that would exist or still be possible in an ANCAP society where an LLC is supposed to tell counterparties like, hey, there's a potential risk here. This is a limited liability corporation. So if they don't do what they say they're going to do, then you can only go after so much. And if you're willing to still engage in commerce with them, you assume that going into that relationship with them. So I think on that level, it's sort of like this, what do you call it? Like it's sort of like a self-policing system where like, it's sort of like a Yelp review or like, hey, my business is only going to be able to, you know, pay out X amount. And if you're still willing to do business with me, that's great. But you assume this risk upon you by transacting with me. So I think that level of it is okay. But you're right. I mean, where they use corporations as like a legal shield for other things or for imposing restrictions on other companies or in these cronyist deals, these private public partnerships, or they're on the revolving door where they're on the boards of certain corporations and then they're in government or lobbyists. That's a totally fucked up system. And it just breeds more of this corruption, like Renault, who when he was betting with Rick, they're going to go 20,000 francs. He's like, oh, make it 10. I'm just a poor corrupt official.
It's awesome that he knows who he is. And, you know, what's funny is I mentioned that Rick comes off as an individualist anarchist, kind of Max Stirnerite at the beginning. But really, if you look at it, it's Renault who is that. Renault is just the complete egoist, the complete I'm in it for myself. And, you know, whoever gets hurt in the meantime, you know, Oh, I'm blackmailing this girl into having sex with me. Oh, that's just a spook. If you know, there's no moral problem there. That's just a spook, as Stirner would say. Yeah, it's
yeah. And Rick was similar, but on the like more of the good side. Like he was like he's like an M&M. You know, he's like got the thin hard candy shell, but inside he's actually kind of a mushy romantic.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, obviously you can see that with Elsa and everything. So. And I really think the scenes that they, when they go to France, I don't think there's any question that they were sexually active. I think it's pretty clear from how they shot it. Yeah. I mean, they weren't showing them back then it was like, if they were going to kiss, they had to have one of them had to have like 1 foot on the floor. If they even like fell on a bed or something like that. And I mean, that's just ridiculous, but even at this point where they're not seen in bed together, it's very clear that they have a sexual relationship. And let me ask you about that. Okay, at that point she knows her husband is in a concentration camp.
I think she didn't discover it till the day the Nazis were coming into Paris. I thought that's what she said, and that he was injured and was hiding in like a rail car or something like that. Like she had thought he was dead and then had this relationship with Rick. And then when they were going to leave together to train to Marseille, that day she discovered that he was actually alive. And that's why she didn't leave with Rick. And Rick got burned bad by that. Like, I think that's what made him have this hard exterior. Because as we see in the flashback scenes to Paris, he's actually a pretty happy-go-lucky, good-natured guy. And then when he's, you know, when we see him in Casablanca, he's like, he's got that, you know, fuck you attitude, like, women, I think he saw his relationship with her as like the one. And when he got burned by that, he just wasn't open to having that level of relationship again. Like he sort of had women and Renault had this great line of like, oh, you have women that you can just kind of throw away. Maybe I'll call on her later. Something like that.
So wait a minute. So are we clear that Elsa, when they have that three group session where they're all talking and we're like making plans to get married and whatnot, then they plan to leave and meet at the train station. And then off screen, she finds out that he's alive, or she knows in that scene.
I took it that she did not know at that time, but she said she had to go take care of some stuff. So it's, I guess it's possible, but it's not revealed in the movie until towards the very end, when she finally is able to get it out to Rick, like what the situation was. Cause like she comes to him that one night and tries to tell him, and then he's so drunk that he's like pushing her away.
Right. Well, maybe I need to watch the movie again, but I could have sworn that when they were in that scene and he starts talking about marriage and stuff, she kind of takes a step back, like, whoa. Like it almost felt like she knew at that time. Mm. Maybe I was imagining things. I don't know.
I could read that as well, but also, I mean, she was married to a guy who just got killed in a concentration camp.
Yeah, I saw that as a hole in the plot. I saw it as a problem in the plot.
Okay, because I saw it as like Elsa, she kind of had a duty to tell him, and that she wasn't kind of telling. I don't know. That was seemed.
Well, she did make it
like
a condition
thing on her part.
She did make it a condition of their relationship. It's like, no questions. We're not going to talk about the past. We're just getting to know each other, you know, going forward or in the moment or whatever. You know, it's
red flag.
Yeah.
Red flag.
I think it's funny that you mentioned that, oh, in France, Rick is this happy-go-lucky mercenary, war mercenary.
Yeah, running guns in Ethiopia and fighting on the loyalist side in Spain, right?
Yeah.
Always the underdog, too, right? Because both sides lost.
Well, he was fighting the fascists in Spain, so maybe this movie won't get canceled. I don't know.
It's right in the name. He fought
an anti-fascist. Come on.
It's in the name. National Socialist.
That's what it means.
So another really good line I really liked was he's talking about this is the Laszlo character when he's about to go out to that meeting that gets busted up. And he says to Ilsa, to tell you the truth, I'm frightened too, but shall I remain here in this hotel room hiding, or shall I carry on as the best I can? And I liken that to like today's environment. Like, should we all remain in our homes hiding from a virus, or should we carry on, realize that this has a less than 1% mortality? It's a 99%+ survival rate. And it's just something that we got to deal with and move on and continue making life better by being productive members of society. And that resonated with me related to this movie that's 80 years old or whatever it is now.
Yeah, man.
No arguments there.
Yeah.
I thought I was being controversial.
No, yeah, you got super disagreement here, buddy. Lock everything down.
Lock it down. Wear a mask, Grandma. Buddy. Where's your mask, Robert? Come on.
I get one when I go to Costco. Oh, no, they don't even give you one, do they? You got to bring your own.
I think they, for a time, were offering them if you didn't have one. And you could also tell me you have a medical condition. Another related to this concept of present day and the masks and all this stuff, and also from the movie, Rick asks the waiter, how long, or the maitre d', how long can I afford to stay closed? And the response is 2 weeks, maybe three. You know, and here we are.
Keep everybody on.
Yeah. And here we are on month five, right?
Jesus.
There are so many restaurants. I don't know where you guys are, but there are so many restaurants around here that have closed forever.
Oh, it's ridiculous, man.
There
are chains here that have closed. There are chains that we used to go to. It was in our like monthly rotation that have closed. You have no, don't even get me started.
Yeah. The lives ruined for a 1% mortality or under 1%. It's insanity.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, Rick's got payroll and he's got rent and he's got expenses and he's only got so much money, you know, in the coffers, right. To play that out. And you know, he was running a gambling operation and one would assume that it's fairly lucrative, you know, like he was able to give away 20,000 francs to help that Bulgarian couple get out of town. So it's not like he wasn't doing well, but even with all of that, even doing well, even having an illegal gambling operation that the police prefect would turn a blind eye to and even participate in, he could still only last 2 or 3 weeks being closed before being busted. It's it's an enlightening idea, you know, that like, I think there's this perception that businesses can just take it, you know?
No, they're evil capitalists. They deserve it, whatever. But yeah, go ahead, Daniel.
Like they're just rich. And if they don't pay you more, it's because they're exploiting you. And if, you know, they can't afford to pay a living wage and they don't deserve to be a business or something ridiculous, you know? And Pete, you were saying earlier, you know, corporations, they're all, they act like a state and they are creations of the state. And I agree with you on, you know, 99% of that. But I still think that a group of people coming together to collectively, you know, coordinate their efforts to make productive goods and services in some corporation type structure is what drives society forward. So I think it is beneficial.
The problem with that, as long as you're not getting special privileges, and that's the problem with going into business with the state, which is what you do when you incorporate. You basically go into business with the state. I mean, the state telling businesses that they have to mandate that people wear masks, the state telling, and not only the United States, but the government of Israel telling Facebook that they have to take down certain accounts. I mean, that you've just become an arm of the state. I'm sorry, you've lost your private status in my opinion. So, yeah, I mean, and someone questioned me on that today, and I said, okay, if 98% of my income came from private transactions, but 2% came from the government telling me that I had to destroy these three businesses, I had to destroy three businesses every year. Am I an arm of the state or not, even though it's only 2% of my business? I mean, the state told me to do something and I did it and I destroyed people's lives in the process. So that's.
Yeah. It goes back to that. Where do you draw that line on the principles argument?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's unfortunate.
You have to do it. Oh, you know, it's like I said, I'm an officer in a corporation, but it's, you know, it's a production company. So, I mean, really what's, if the government wants to silence us, they just won't allow our product on a platform or something like that, you know?
Right. And then, which is happening more and more these days.
Although our documentary within the next 48 hours should be available on Amazon. So. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. Cool. Yeah. Well, we will definitely put a link to that on our show notes page at lastnightedge.com/132. And I did watch that, and it is well done. I really enjoyed the graphic animations, and you have a murderer's row of libertarian, philosophical minded people, interview style. It's awesome.
That was all me except for David Friedman. David Friedman was not, David Friedman, James C. Scott. James C. Scott was Chris, got him. But for the most part, pretty much everyone that we interviewed, it was, you know, that's why I was pretty much brought into the project was, oh, you've interviewed all these people on your podcast. So, yeah, talk to them about this documentary thing.
Yeah. See, you're doing these Rick style deals in the background there.
Oh, yeah. It was very Rick, very Rick. I need more bourbon.
All right. So I have a question. Did either of you guys buy the romance that was being sold in this, and did it have overtones of like this weak, helpless woman who can't make up her own mind? And so she, you know, says, Rick, you have to think for both of us. Did that bother either of you guys? Or is that a case of looking at something from the past through a present day lens? I'll go to Robert.
Well, for your first question, I wouldn't call this like one of the great love stories of all time. I think it's got a lot of great quotes. And there's a lot of great dialogue, but I wouldn't say that this is, you know, a relationship that you're like, you totally believe. At least I did not totally believe it, but because we just get a few back, you know, scenes, flashback scenes, and that's not enough to really establish their relationship. You see them when they're happy, you see them, and then you see them when they're miserable. And later on, you don't see them meeting and getting to know each other. Those scenes are crucial in any kind of romance scene, you know, when they're actually becoming friends and they're learning about each other and making each other laugh and that kind of thing. And that's what we react to emotionally when seeing two people fall in love on a screen. What was the second part of your question there, Daniel?
Oh, did his interaction with Ilsa and sort of this he's kind of this manly man, and she's sort of this helpless, like, oh, you got to think for the both of us, Rick.
Well, she was definitely gamble. She had a lot on her plate. I mean, she had a lot of conflict in her, which I can appreciate, I suppose. I mean, she's got two different men she can choose from, sort of. One of this driven work guy, and this other guy that she's more in love with on a personal level. I didn't necessarily have a problem with the, oh, just start doing the thinking for us situation, because I could see her at the end of her rope just wanting someone else to do that for her. And you know, women, I think, also find men attractive when they kind of take charge and that sort of thing. And then when they break up with him, then they say, oh, well, he was too controlling. but in the moment, they really like that take charge kind of guy.
Yeah, I don't buy her as a strong female character. I don't. She just seems like the kind of character that is actually driven. Her identity is based upon the man she's with at that point.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
I'm sorry, you know, I mean, it's 1942. Come on. I mean, think about it, you know. Yeah, she's not a very strong character. However hard the wind blows is where she'll go. I think that taking away, not concentrating on her strength, but concentrating on her loyalty, I think that she is loyal to Victor. And that she'll, and it, I think that comes across in the fact that she's really willing to do anything to get the paperwork to get her, to get them out of Casablanca.
Yeah, even point a gun at Rick to try to get it. Yeah, and I think that she was conflicted, and she would have been actually kind of like okay with either scenario. Like, I think she really was torn. They said that she had only been married to Laszlo for like 8 weeks before they got separated. And so it was kind of like a newlywed situation. And then I think she really had a passionate love with Rick. And so like her heart was telling her to go there, but then Rick, you know, made the decision for her at the end, which I think was, it's amazing. They didn't know what the ending was going to be when they're making this, but it ended so well. Like, yeah, it's the right move. You know, Rick says, you know what? You're what drives him to do what he does. And he needs you to be there for him so that he can do the important work that he needs to do. And, you know, the selfless act for him was to push her to go with him and fly off to Lisbon. And I don't think it could have ended better. Like, if he ends up with Ingrid Bergman in this movie, I think it ruins the movie.
I think it's a worse movie for sure, especially since I didn't buy the whole romance to begin with. So, or I necessarily didn't buy it, but I wasn't invested in their romance. So,
right. And those scenes were all added. Like the second writer added those because he's like, well, we need a little bit more of like them being romantic, like being into each other. But go ahead, Pete. Sorry.
No. I just think it makes more sense that he ends up with Renault and that they're going off to do business together, that they're going to go off and, you know, do whatever, run guns or do whatever they're going to do together. That just makes a lot more sense for who Rick actually is. The relationship with Elsa in Paris, actually, if you look at the history they gave of his character, that's just an anomaly. Rick is who he is. He's, you know, a wheeler dealer. He's somebody who's going to be sleeping with any girl who walks into the bar, who, you know, gives him a second look and everything. And yeah, that's how Rick had to end up.
Yeah, and that was definitely, Renault was a better pairing for his character in the film. You get more of him and Renault interacting as this kind of dynamic duo pairing. So absolutely, I'd have to agree with both of you guys.
Yeah, and I really love there was a lot of unspokenness between Renault and Rick. It's like, you have the papers, right? I know you have the papers. Like, I'm not saying I have the papers, but, you know, I have the papers.
It's a true bromance. It really is. To bring up a word probably no one's heard in about 5 years.
Yeah, bringing it back. All right. Well, speaking of bringing it back, we are about at the end of our time here. So does anyone have any final notes that they want to make sure that they cover before we get into what we call final summary and review? And we give it a score of some sort. Just give us a scale and a relative, like out of how many whatevers. We used to have just black and gold, black and red. And then we started a numbering system. And then recently we've just gone off the rails and just made up different numbering schemes or different ratings for each individual person on every show. It's totally unique and different. But any final notes from anyone?
You want to go first, Robert?
No, I have no final notes. Go ahead, Pete.
Oh, I just think it's anyone who is an agorist who's into black and gray markets, I think they would love this. It's not a perfect movie, but it's pretty damn close to perfect. So if I had to scale it on 10, it would be a 9, maybe at like a 9.25. I just think that if you like West Wing, if you like like The Newsroom, if you like movies like A Few Good Men, where there's really snappy dialogue that's clever, this is the movie for you. If someone puts it on, I'm going to watch it. I don't care if I watch it the night before. It's just one of those movies.
All right. Yeah. Very good. Go ahead.
Okay.
Robert.
Okay. So, from a time when all you had was character and dialogue and story, this is a standout. I put in this on the epsilon of like Billy Wilder and his top movies. I don't remember if I'd seen this movie before, so I don't know, but I was familiar, of course, with all the quotes and things, and maybe I'd seen bits and pieces, but this movie is still eminently watchable. It'll be watchable in 100 years. It's a story that is true to its characters and its setting and its location. It doesn't try to do anything stupid. And it's crazy that it was all made up basically at the last minute, or, they were working with the script as it went along. And it passed through that many different writers. Usually when there's that many different hands in the pot, it gets all muddled and you're like, well, what was that even about? Because, there's like 50 different producers, kids in some shot or something. It's just like ridiculous. But no, it's a great movie. I'm going to give it I'll give it a 9. I think Pete, you gave it a 9. I'm going to give it a 9 as well. It's a movie from another time, but I think it'll still appeal to today's audiences. Maybe not. I don't know if you're like some millennial kid and all you want is some CGI stuff. I don't know. But if you're into any kind of character and story and, funny dialogue with likable characters, then you'll feel right at home with Casablanca.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you guys both for your comments. And I'm going to just echo all of that. I think that this is a very well done movie. It is a deserved classic. In watching it again, I got to say, I mean, I can't imagine them doing anything really differently. It's just amazingly well done. It's beautifully shot. There's a lot of framing that's done and smooth camera work, the witty dialogue, and the story just has a nice arc. It opens with the Roundup the Usual Suspects. It ends with Roundup the Usual Suspects. It has a nice bookend. I'm going to go with a 10 on this. I mean, it's probably the first 10 I've ever given on the show. And one of our listeners is saying, wow, a 9 from Robert. That's unheard of. Well, there you go. So we finally delivered, everybody. That's our show for tonight, everyone. You can hit us up for some Kathy and Turner Overdrive after this. It's available for our Patreon supporters. Hit us up at lastnarrative.com/Patreon. Do check out Pete's show at Freeman Beyond the Wall. And also, you do work at the Libertarian Institute. You're one of the editors there, right?
I'm the managing editor, and I have a new article dropping on Thursday that I'm going to be very interested in seeing what people think. I was channeling a couple different writers when I wrote it.
Okay, very good. Yeah, if you could just point out that one to me in Messenger or whatever, I'll make sure we put it on the show notes for this episode, 132, lastnarrative.com/132. And Robert, next week, we're going to have Rachel Kennerly of Cannabis Heals Me back to talk about the merit.
Awesome. I love her. She's so sweet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We've had her on a bunch of times and she's awesome. And her show is great. And we're going to be doing a marijuana themed movie, a caper film, The Gentleman, starring Matthew McConaughey. So,
okay.
All right. It's going to be a good one. So Robert, why don't you tell everyone how they can support the show? They could do Patreon like our last guest, Bobby did. He's now one of our patrons. We've gotten, it's also weird. We've gotten, I don't know if it's weird, but it's good. I've gotten emails and messages from people like the last couple of weeks, like from 4 or 5 different people recommending movies to us or saying, hey, your guys' show, I just really like it. I just want to let you guys know. And I was showing my wife and she's like, you know, it, your show's good. I listen to it, whatever. I have to say that I'm your wife, but she thought it's because of people are sort of like locked down for so long. They're looking to maybe have some connection. And so people have been reaching out a little bit, and I'm actually blown away by it. It's kind of awesome. So thank you everyone for all the kind messages and the Patreon support lately. But anyway, Robert, how else can they support what we do here?
Well, I like what you just said. They can send us private messages and make us feel really, really good about ourselves. But you could go to Trepster.com and you could buy some merchandise there. You could leave a positive review on Google or what is it? Like Apple Podcasts, I think.
Apple Podcasts, iTunes.
I think that's what they're called these days. But you could subscribe to our YouTube channel. You could leave a review or leave a thumbs up. You could subscribe. You could talk about us in the comments. You could complain about everything I say in the comments. You could contact us directly through this show on the Facebook. You could join our private Facebook group if you you know, support us on the Patreon. So there's a million different ways you could do that. And I'm not, you know, that's not a comprehensive list. You can use your own innovative means to talk about your friends, talk to your friends about us. You could tell them some secrets, tell them some rumors. You never know. There's something going on.
All right. And also check out Pete's show. That would support us because we like him. We have a beautiful friendship with Pete, and he has a great show. 440 episodes long so far and still counting. So, wow. And we appreciate the work that you do. And I still just always think of you as Mance. So
it's fine. Wow. Someone asked me recently, said, "Oh, do you ever get upset that I think it was Kinsella. Kinsella's like, do you ever get upset that people, because we saw each other in New Hampshire and he's like, he came up to me and he called me Mance. He's like, did that upset you? I'm like, no, I mean, come on. It's what I chose to be called at first. How am I going to, why would I be upset at anybody like that? So, yeah.
Yeah, it's like we're in the club now. We knew you way back when, right?
Yeah.
So,
oh yeah, yeah.
It's like New England clam chowder. Is it the red or the white?
It's the white. Manhattan's red.
All right. Well, that's our show tonight, everyone. And if you can stick around, Pete, for a little bit longer for the Capington Overdrive, we would appreciate that. And thank you guys for being our listeners. We really appreciate it. And what's the last thing I'm going to say other than good night from last night is looking. Here's looking at you, kids. All right, we're going to continue the transmission for another minute or two on the Actual Anarchy podcast before we get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive. And I try to save a difficult question for this portion of the show that is not so normally safe usually. So my question is, when you'd recommended this, Pete, we saw somebody in the part of the problem group, I think it was Gene Epstein, write something about Gone with the Wind and cancel culture kind of affecting different other movies and TV shows. And we commented, hey, we need to do Casablanca real soon because there's probably something in here that people aren't going to like. And that is when Ilsa calls Sam a boy, I think. And that was the only thing that stood out to me that could even, though I'm jaded, like, I don't know what people are going to get Snowflake, you know, burned up about. But in my mind, there is no disrespect towards Sam in this movie at all. In fact, like we said earlier, Rick's trying to get him a bigger cut if he sells the business. So do you guys think that this is at risk of getting hit with cancel culture based on that? What do you think, Pete?
No, neither is Gone with the Wind. They're just too big. They're just too big. They'll survive this. When she said, when she made that comment, yeah, that was cringe. I mean, I cringed when she said that and everything, but yeah, I don't see that happening with this. It, No, not in my opinion.
What do you think, Robert?
Well, like you said, you never can predict the next outrage. Like, I wouldn't have been able to predict that syrup and whatever else. I mean, I don't think anybody's really getting their panties up in a bunch about it, but nobody's like outraged that they're canceling it. And it's the companies themselves that are doing it, right? In kind of anticipation that, you know, this is problematic or whatever.
It's so, a virtue signal, yeah.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, maybe, you know, it is corporations that are very, very sensitive to some blue check marks on Twitter, right? I mean, it was like, what, one or two people, maybe one person that complained about Gone with the Wind. And then HBO was like, yeah, holy smokes, this is super problematic. Let's put a disclaimer at the front and talk about all this crap. So I don't know who owns the copyright or the whatever the rights to Casablanca, but it could very well be on the chopping block. Pretty much anything. Like, what was there, that B article today or yesterday? It was talking about how Hamilton is problematic now, and that was made like 4 years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, the rapid acceleration of the progressive cancel culture, I wouldn't put it past them, but this is a beloved film, like Pete's saying, and it does have its protectors and defenders. So I don't know who wins out in the end.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see it. And sneak preview, everyone. Spoilers, we're doing Hamilton after The Gentlemen. So we're getting into some rhyming, apparently. But that's available on the old Disney Plus. And so, Robert, you and I will be able to watch that. And we're going to have Tho Bishop of the Mises Institute on for that one. He's a bit of a Hamilton scholar.
Tho's awesome, man. I've hung out with him many times at Mises. He's a really cool dude. I think you'll have a great time with him. Loves to talk. And always has great information. I mean, he's great. But yeah.
All right. Very good. Well, that's going to do it for the Actual Anarchy portion of the show. So join us next week with Rachel Kennerly of Canada Seals Me for The Gentleman. And then we'll follow that up with Hamilton. And as always, maximum freedom, everyone. Thank you. And peace out.
Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.